Voice explores community issues through the lens of local residents. We've spent time talking with entrepreneurs about their experiences running small businesses and how they've adapted during the pandemic. Now we're getting local perspectives on COVID-19, the vaccine, and barriers to accessing it. I'm your host, Erica Pfizer, and this week I'm joined by Dr. Vincent Sevier, Chief Medical Officer of Methodist Hospitals. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Sevier.
Thanks for having me, Erica. It's great to be here, and hopefully I can add value to your listeners.
Wonderful. Tell me more about your role and what the Chief Medical Officer does for Methodist Hospitals.
Sure. As a Chief Medical Officer for a hospital, I'm primarily the physician leadership for all things physician-related on the medical staff. In addition to that, I support all clinical initiatives, growth, and clinical programs that we develop with the goal of improving quality and patient safety.
And this year, as we know, has been unprecedented, really, in healthcare the past year. Looking back over the past year and the beginning of the pandemic till now, can you give me an idea of how your operations changed?
Certainly. It has been a significant challenge. I think that we've had big changes to our operations, but I think we responded rapidly to the crisis that was at hand. I would say back in March of 2020, when they put in place the stay-at-home orders, by that time, we had already begun to have significant conversations about the possibility of having large numbers of COVID cases in Northwest Indiana and how that would impact our care in the organization and what changes we would need to put in place. So when that stay-at-home order came, it wasn't a surprise, and we were able to respond rapidly. I think because we had the burning platform, you know, it was on television, everyone was aware of it. It was really a call to arms, and mm-hmm. I think we were able to mobilize our teams to try to come up with solutions to better provide the care for the patients in the facility. Some of the things that we put in place to try to respond to the need, one of the things we identified was that testing at that time, it was back in the spring, was significantly limited. Mm-hmm. And so we really led the way in Northwest Indiana. We stood up two drive-through testing sites, one in the Merrillville campus, one in our Gary campuses, and we started to provide testing to the community. And to date, we've probably done over 40,000 tests or so. One of the things I think we did practically to try to make patients comfortable and ensure that we were reducing any spread or exposure was to enhance our safety and cleaning protocols. So we started to schedule procedures that patients were having and stretch them out to decrease the number of individuals that would be in waiting areas. We enhanced our cleaning with more frequency of cleaning with sort of common areas or high traffic, high touch areas. But in addition to that, we were always taking temperatures when patients were presenting, checking for symptoms as well. And then we always use universal masking throughout all of our facilities.
Now, you mentioned testing, and I think as we get further into vaccine distribution, people are more focused on the vaccine than they are getting tested for COVID. So what are your thoughts on that? How has testing for COVID changed?
Yeah, I think the difference really has been just sort of the progression of the pandemic in and of itself. In the beginning, when we first started, there weren't a lot of treatment options. We didn't yet have a vaccine at the time. Testing is what we had to really know if you're someone who had been exposed, you're having symptoms, you get tested, at least you could quarantine and try to prevent exposure to others. And that was very humbling. As a healthcare provider, you know, your call to serve is to help. and you felt in some ways that you didn't have everything you needed to try to help patients get better because this virus was just so new. And so it was a lot of preventative measures, trying to keep people safe. As we went on, more therapeutics came out with monoclonal antibodies, some of the antiviral type treatment regimens that we were using. And we started to really turn the corner in terms of helping patients heal and discharge from the hospital. And then we started to see hopefully some light at the end of the tunnel in the back half of 2020 when the conversation shifted towards when is the vaccine coming. And once the vaccine came out toward the winter, I guess it was December of 2020 or so, then the focus became, well, let's get as many individuals vaccinated so that we can decrease the spread. And that's really been our focus to this point.
And looking at the past few months that the vaccine has been available, how do you think the rollout has gone? Has it been a smooth rollout, in your opinion? Are you getting the number of vaccines in that demand requires?
Yeah, definitely I think so. One of the things that I would say, and I think Hoosiers should be very proud of, you know, I interact with, you know, others who have my role, my counterparts in other states, other parts of the country, and I'll tell you that the processes that we've had here in Indiana have served the communities well. You know, early on, the one thing we had a lot of concern about with the vaccines was, could the supply keep up with demand? And supply was limited, and we had to very strategically roll out in phases who would be eligible to receive, starting with those most at risk, healthcare workers, first-line responders to protect the infrastructure and community support of the healthcare system. As supply became more widespread, we methodically went down expanding, you know, who would be eligible. Other states, sometimes they struggled with just opening it up and not having the supply. And then there was tremendous frustration from residents in those states that they couldn't get an appointment. And I found here, and certainly in Northwest Indiana, using the state's registration system that we use to book appointments, which assures you a vaccine, it also assures you the next dose of the vaccine. I felt that that's been a very methodical approach to getting people vaccinated. And now we're in a position that we're starting to have more supply than we do demand for the vaccine. And so we've helped support, you know, through coordination with the Indiana Department of Health. We've helped support a few different vaccine clinics. We have one in each of our locations, one in Merrillville, one in Gary. We have a vaccine clinic at our Sherrillville Immediate Care location as well. And through a coordinated effort with Indiana Department of Health, FEMA, Homeland Security, we also helped to support a mass vaccination site in Gary off of 25th Avenue and Harrison there. So I think there's been a lot of efforts to provide access and push the vaccine out. It's certainly there, and my recommendation would be if you're eligible to please get out and get your vaccine.
I have my second dose tomorrow. I went to the Roosevelt site and I have my second one, and it was very seamless. The process was so smooth from registration to drive up. So I also would encourage anyone who is thinking about going to get their vaccine to go to the Roosevelt site or any of the other mass vaccination clinics.
Excellent.
So you mentioned that that there has been, I guess, a decline in demand. What do you attribute that to most people getting the vaccine, or do you think that we're reaching a wall where the people who aren't getting vaccinated are probably not going to, or there's some hesitation or some barriers to reaching them? What do you think is happening?
Yeah, so I think it may be multifactorial. I mean, certainly what we see at our site, since we started vaccinating the week before Christmas in December. So since that time, we've done over 45,000 doses. We probably do, it varies, but between 500 to 750 a day in terms of vaccines, and we're still seeing that consistency. However, I do think you have communities, cultural variation and differences, lack of awareness, and just a general hesitancy because the vaccines really are still new to people, and there's just this uncertainty. We've had, I think, all the major professional institutions, CDC, FDA, even the medical societies really support the vaccine, but individuals are still hesitant, I think, taking more of a wait-and-see approach. I think with continued efforts and just continuing to sustain education, pushing out to the community, doing services like this, a public service announcement, and trying to educate the community on the benefits of the vaccine, that we're starting to break through. We do see the numbers coming up in some of our more challenged communities, definitely, but we still have a ways to go. For instance, I'm imagining that we are going to have an increased need as we come into the fall and we start to think about getting back to school. And over the summer here, we're talking about opening up, restaurants and sporting events and facilities. And so I think there will be an increased demand. I think we really have to make sure we have enough access so that anyone who desires a vaccine can really get it without a lot of difficulty. And that's really what we're striving to do right now.
Yes, I think there are some physical or transportation cultural barriers. And then there is also a lot of misinformation out there about how a vaccine works, how it was developed. Could you give an elementary, not the explanation that you would get in medical school, but an explanation that we could all understand about how the vaccine works?
Yeah, thanks, Erica. I think you're right. There's a lot of misinformation out there, or probably mischaracterization of the way vaccines work. I guess a couple things I'll touch on and sort of explain it, and I'll try to tackle it this way. At the very basic levels, viruses are very, very small particles that can cause significant infection. The interesting thing about viruses is that they can't reproduce, so they can't really live without a host. Mm-hmm. They need a host to survive. And unfortunately, that's where we come in. As people or humans, when viruses infect us, they basically attach to your cells in your body, and they inject their virus into your cells. The reason they do that is because our cells are very good at helping them reproduce. So they essentially hijack or take over our cells and use that to make copies of themselves. And once they make a number of copies, they multiply in your body, and they continue to do that to different cells in your body. So that's how they infect us. Once your body has seen that virus for the first time, your immune system responds, and you start to create the defense against it, which are antibodies. So that the next time your body sees that infection, it will recognize it as foreign, and the antibody will attack the virus and protect you. Now, that's what happens when someone gets infected with COVID. That's the natural process of how they develop antibodies. Where the vaccine comes in is that if you just waited for everyone to get infections, that would take a really long time. A lot of people can get sick, and unfortunately, many may not survive. And what science decided to do was say, well, what if we could create a vaccine, put it in a person, it doesn't actually infect them, but trick the body into making the antibody to defend so that when the real virus comes, that antibody will attack and defend that person and help them. And that's essentially the COVID vaccine.
I am still with you, which means I think that was a good explanation because I followed along the whole way. So
great.
And so I think that, you know, what you're saying is we should feel comfortable that, you know, this vaccine is giving us the antibodies we need to fight off the virus should we come into contact with it. And so, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the takeaways are that the vaccine has been tested. They have been seen to be safe. Millions and millions of doses have been administered without, you know, significant repercussions, you know, side effects, adverse events or reactions. So people should feel comfortable taking it. The vaccine itself doesn't infect you. Some people worry about the, you know, well, I felt like I had symptoms or I felt sick after that second dose. That's not actually you getting sick. That's actually your immune system responding and making the antibodies. Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing. That means it's certainly working. Now, you don't always, you know, have that fever, chills, body aches, and that's okay. But certainly when you feel it, your immune system is responding and you're making those protective antibodies that are going to help you if you do get exposed to the actual virus.
That's how we know it's working, if we feel some of those symptoms.
But, that's right.
So when is a time that you should be concerned about the symptoms you have, if you have them after a vaccine? And what's kind of a normal reaction?
So most of the time, what we've seen have been mild. And there are sort of the mild symptoms that you would feel if you were coming down with, let's say, you know, the flu as we know it. Sometimes you feel chills. You feel a little achy. You might feel weak, have some little shivers. Some people have a very sort of mild or low-grade headache. I think that's probably the most common. Mm-hmm. And others will just kind of generally say fatigue. Fever is plus minus, you know, doesn't always happen. I'll tell you, when I had mine, nothing after the first dose. About 36 hours after the second dose, started to feel it. It lasted for 6 hours, and then it was completely gone. And I had some general aches, a little chills. I was grilling in the backyard, and I continued to do that. It wasn't something that made me sick that I had to stop. Mm-hmm. And then it was over, and it passed, and had nothing else. I think usually those symptoms will last between 1 to 2 days, and we would attribute that to having the vaccine. You know, if you're having significant symptoms that go beyond 72 hours, let's say, then it might be time to at least ask the question of your doctor, could something else be going on? Occasionally, what we've actually seen is people come in to get the vaccine and they were exposed at some point and didn't even know they had COVID. Mm-hmm. And then we check them later on and find out that they actually had COVID and they were just unaware. So it's just something to be aware of.
So sometimes it's just coincidence that you may have gotten sick at the same time that you got your vaccine shortly before.
Exactly.
So I've heard the term herd immunity used, but how do we know when we've reached herd immunity?
Yeah, herd immunity is sort of like this, you know, panacea. I think we all want to get there. It's been a trying year in terms of 2020 and now heading into 2021. You know, certainly I think we want to get back to, you know, what people identify as normal, our regular lives and enjoying time with friends and family and feel that herd immunity will get us there. Herd immunity, it doesn't mean that you eradicate the virus or that the virus is completely gone. It essentially just means that it doesn't spread as easily. And then those who are at the highest risk don't succumb to it and aren't impacted through hospitalizations and need for treatment. You know, the number that's been, I think, communicated and thrown out, and this is based on sort of history, traditional models in terms of infectious protocols and vaccines, is 70%. That's the number that's thrown out there. But there's a lot of variation in that number because it depends on populations and how easily virus spread. So if you're in a densely populated area, a lot of people, viruses spread very easily. If you're in a more rural area, fewer people, less chance for the virus to spread. So a higher number is needed, cities, densely populated areas. A lower number to reach herd immunity is needed for more rural areas. I don't think that you're going to hear the CDC come out and say, we've reached herd immunity.
Mm-hmm.
I think what will happen is we're following the data, you know, daily. I'm on weekly calls with the Indiana Department of Health. We have advisory groups. We check in with the CDC on these calls as well. And what we're looking for and monitoring are positivity rates. And you'll start to see a rapid decline in the positivity rates, the new cases, hospitalizations, and those needing treatment. And it'll start to plateau and sort of tail off. And that will give you a sense that we've got enough vaccine, people vaccinated in the community, and we have enough individuals who unfortunately have already been exposed and infected, but they have antibodies, that we're starting to see a significant decline in cases, and that will start to approach herd immunity.
And then we can all get back safely to our ball games, our summer barbecues, right?
I think that's the goal, and that's the plan. I know I'd be looking forward to it. Certainly, I think we all want to get out there and enjoy the summer. I think you're going to start to hear from local municipalities. There's a way to get out there and do some of that in a responsible way. There's a lot of people in Indiana who've been fully vaccinated to this point. I would say there's about maybe close to 6.5-7 million people in the state, and at least 2 million are fully vaccinated. And then there's another number beyond that that have received their first dose. So I think over the next coming months here, you're going to get more and more people vaccinated. But as long as we continue to, you know, do some of the social distancing, you know, we're outside when we need to be, you're washing the hands, and then, you know, making sure we're still using our masking appropriately, I think we're going to start to bend the curve and the numbers will drop off.
And the CDC did come out and say we can gather outside with fully vaccinated people in small groups without our masks.
Yep.
When would you encourage people to still wear their masks? Why is it important to still mask if you have the vaccine?
So generally, we follow the CDC's, you know, recommendation, and they put forth those guidelines. You can certainly, you know, see it on their website. There's a lot of detail that speaks to, you know, if you're a family unit, you know, a close group, if it's someone who's coming in who's not a part of your family unit, and, you know, all those things. And sometimes I think it's difficult to keep it all straight. My general rule of thumb is I'm always generally socially, you know, distanced with anyone who's not in my direct family. I don't care if that's extended family or just friends who are coming over. We've seen, I think, way too often, you know, friends or extended families who we're very close with and we know, but sometimes they can't control others who've contacted them, and it just becomes a multiple of risk. So in general, I tend to social distance. I keep the hand washing. We try to limit contact and high risk settings. Certainly if you're going into public, you know, facilities, you know, you still recommend, you know, wearing the mask. It's still uncertain and it's being looked into as to whether or not if you receive the vaccine, can you continue to spread? And that question is still completely unanswered, though there's a suggestion that maybe not. So continue to do the hand washing, socially distance, you know, for your recreational time, I think throughout the summer, you know, try to be smart, you know, as best as you can, follow those CDC recommendations with your family. And I think that's what's going to make the difference. And then hopefully get us in a better situation in the fall.
And you manage a large staff of doctors and nurses who have worked very hard over this past year. How is your staff handling the workload? How are you managing their own health, their mental health?
You know, even before COVID, you know, I would say I'm an emergency physician by training. You know, that's a high volume, high stress, can be high pressure environment, a lot of activity, a lot of things going on. As a chief medical officer, which is more administrative, so then you have this broader responsibility, like you're saying, for staff and for docs. It was always a challenge to ensure that, you know, teams were taking care of themselves, taking the appropriate time. It can be a stressful environment to work in. I think in general, the staff that works at the hospitals, they generally have this unselfish concern for the welfare of others, to help others. And I think many of them during this time put their own lives and safety on the line, stepping up to care for patients and serve the community. I think those were heroic acts, and everyone thanks them for that. Many had their own personal, bout with COVID. They recovered. They came back to serve. Some lost family members due to COVID. They returned to serve. And, you know, I really hope that, or at least I'm hopeful, that the younger generation of these clinicians will feel inspired in this moment. This is, I think it's going to be the largest public health crisis, certainly of our time. And I hope that those individuals feel inspired to continue to serve. You know, you try to take the time out that you can and, you know, focus on a hobby, spend time with family, disconnect, remove a little bit of the stress. But we definitely need the providers to continue to serve the community. And so I think things that are going to be different for them that this crisis has sort of brought about, and I guess it's the whole thing around, you know, nothing breeds innovation like necessity. When all this was going on, because we had to, patients stopped coming to the hospital or didn't want to come to their doctor's visit, or they had issues with transportation, maybe they were fearful, risk of exposure. Even though we were doing all the temperature checks and symptoms and cleaning everything and trying to reassure, we understood it. And I think we've been making an effort to meet patients where they're at. And so the clinical teams, doctors and nurses, they've had to change the way they provide care. And I think that's going to continue into the future. And that one of those big changes has been the introduction of telehealth or telemedicine. It's huge. And so we had to introduce in all of our clinics, in our immediate care centers, the ability to get a telehealth visit when you want one, because you couldn't make it into your doc, to make sure that your clinical needs were still met. And we're continuing to try to grow that platform out.
Well, thank you so much for sharing and for being with us today, Dr. Sevier. we all appreciate your service, the service of your hospital staff. So thankful to have them in the area. I know you all are working so hard.
Well, I appreciate it, Erica. I thank you for the opportunity to be an ambassador for Methodist. I guess I would leave your listeners with probably just a couple things. One, make sure you get a vaccine if you're eligible. Two, if you have healthcare needs, certainly don't put those off. You know, we've done everything. We're prepared to receive you. And if you need a place to receive your care, Methodist is willing and able to do that for you. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us this week on Neighborhood Voice. You can visit ourshot219.com for information about local COVID-19 resources in Northwest Indiana. This show is made possible by Legacy Foundation, the Community Foundation for Lake County, Indiana.